You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to The Analyst Inside Cricket. I'm Simon Hughes, and this has been quite a remarkable week in cricket, with Australia suddenly beating India in just 3 days in the first test in Pune, and doing, of course, what England singularly failed to do, which was beat India and beat them handsomely with by 300 runs.
4,502. Do you know what that is?
Your bank balance?
Hardly. The number of days since Australia last won a test match in India before they won in Pune. I'm Simon Mann, and it's a remarkable that Steve Smith knew that. I mean, it's something he said at the press conference, post-match press conference. He knew exactly how many days it was since Australia had last won a test match in India. I think they were niggled, by the fact that everyone was saying it was going to be 4-0. And in a way, they had nothing to lose.
Well, we'll find out exactly how they managed to pull off that heist from Sanjay Mandrekar, who played for India as a batsman in the 1980s, well-known commentator and, in fact, musician. We're going to even hear a bit of his music. So he's going to tell us exactly how Australia did it.
And we'll also look ahead to West Indies against England, a very inexperienced West Indies lineup, and England preparing with more one-day internationals before the Champions Trophy in the summer. Please leave a review on iTunes as well, and also subscribe to The Analyst Inside Cricket so you get the programme automatically each week. Click on the button where it says subscribe.
And maybe you could send a bit of money as well, because if you're saying that your bank balance is certainly not 4,502, it sounds like you need a few, you know, contributions. Charities...
Well, we're coming to the end of the month, Simon. There's always a bit less in there at the end of the month.
Anyway, well, we can get on to money later and talk about what an strange experience it's been for cricket's richest person suddenly, Ben Stokes, who's had a bit of comeuppance in the West Indies. But before that, we should just look at the amazing performance by Australia in India in that first test match. We were in Pune only a month ago at a one-day international. They produced a ragging Turner, India, expecting to win the match comfortably, and the tables were turned.
It doesn't always work out like that, though, if you prepare a pitch where basically you bring the opposition spinners into the game. What you want, and what we saw in the England series against India, was where there was just enough for India's spinners to create the doubt among England's batsmen, but not enough there for England's spinners to do that to India. I suppose when Monty Panesar and Graham Swan bowled India out, say, in Mumbai, when England won there, on their last but one tour, I mean, there was so much turn. They were right in the game. I know they were good spinners anyway, Swan and Panesar, but they were right in the game. I mean, another parallel might be the test matches that England played in Bangladesh, where the ball did turn right from the start, and it did bring Bangladesh right into the game because they had a couple of decent spinners. One thing I thought about Australia's performance is Keefe and Nathan Lyon, really steady bowlers. They don't bowl much rubbish. And I always felt when England were there, one of the problems was that you just sensed that a bad ball was coming along every over, almost with Moeen Ali and Rashid bowling. And they bowled some good balls. Rashid took wickets, but you knew there was a bad ball or two just around the corners. It just takes the pressure off.
Definitely. The other thing is, as you rightly point out, that rough wickets, tricky wickets, are always going to even up the odds between teams. And actually, we used to talk about this a lot when we were playing minor counties matches, when the NatWest or Gillette Cup, you know, from the 1980s, included minor counties as well, certainly in the first couple of rounds. And often you'd be drawn at the minor county, so you'd play at somewhere like High Wycombe or Chesham or somewhere in Cheshire or some, you know, Devon, Exmouth or somewhere like that. And you'd know the pitch was going to be pretty dodgy. In fact, we used to play Ireland and we'd play in Dublin and the pitch was like, I described it once as like Weetabix, you know, that was so crusty.
You've got other problems with going to Dublin as well. The other distractions off the field, yeah, as well, haven't
quite.
You?
But that tends to get evened up by the fact that the Irish get as drunk as you do. So, you know, it's sort of fairly, we start off with a level playing field. But undoubtedly, if the pitch is difficult, different from what the players are brought up on, then, and the ball is turning off dry patches, it means that a bad spinner can get wickets just as easily as a good one. As you point out, the key is to be consistent. And actually, there's an interesting story with this particular match, Steve O'Keefe taking his 12 wickets, and the influence of an Indian on the Australian team. A man you won't have heard of, Sridharan Sriram, quite a mouthful, who played a little bit for Indian ODI teams in the early 2000s, left-arm spinner, left-hand bat, became a coach, has been all around the world as a bit of a jobbing coach, and he's now the Australian spin consultant. And Steve O'Keefe went to him after the first session of play when he bowled fairly innocuously, and they had a talk about how he should bowl, and Sriram gave him his own advice from his experience in India, said, I think, you know, you probably need to bowl a bit flatter and a bit more round arm. And 12 wickets later, it proved to be right because he became unplayable. And I think it did also reveal how poor India are against a turning ball. We all think that Indians are brilliant, but the best batting in the match came from Steve Smith.
It was a brilliant innings in the second innings. The only thing I would say about it is that, to some extent, the pressure was off. The game was decided in the first innings, wasn't it? Once Australia got that first innings lead of about 150, it's very hard to get yourself back in the game. You really have to bowl the opposition out then in the third innings for about 70 or 80, yeah, something like that.
Yeah. They lost 7 for 11 in that first innings in India, didn't they? And, I mean, you know, the batting was appalling. And nobody can play spin in the world. You look at the top four bowlers in the Test rankings, three of them are spinners. Ashwin, Jadeja and Harath of Sri Lanka. You know, orthodox spinners. I mean, OK, Ashwin has his Karen balls and stuff, but essentially he's a fairly orthodox bowler, and certainly Jadeja and Harath are, and now we've got Steve O'Keefe as well. Nobody can play orthodox spin. If you just drop it on a line and length and there's a bit of turn, batsmen panic. And I think also there is this extra little bit of influence of the DRS and the fact that now the ball can be the decision can be overturned with the ball just clipping the stumps, which means the stumps are a bit wider. Batsmen are very wary of using their pad as a line of defence. It's changed batsmen's methods against spin and it's changed them for the worse because they haven't got a clue.
Focus on Ashwin and Jadeja as well. India would expect, hope that they would win the game. Well, the first innings, I mean, their figures are not horrendous, not by any means. Between them, they bowled 60 overs. They took 5 for, about 140, which is not a bad effort at all when you're bowling against a team in the first innings. Australia all out for 260. Stark 61 from 63 balls, vital, because it just gave Australia that bit of impetus. But once they had that batting collapse, effectively the game was over. You're chasing 400, 440 in any test match, almost anywhere in the world. You've got no chance on that pitch. You almost might as well shaken hands after the third innings, really, because there's no way they were going to get close.
It was a hell of a pitch, actually, wasn't it? I mean, some of the balls from Nathan Lyon with the new ball were bouncing virtually head high from a length. It's really entertaining stuff. I think it's great for the game to see batsmen taxed in this way and have to fathom out a plan. And one man, above all others, has fathomed out a plan. And you wouldn't think from looking at him that he would be able to play spin in the way that he does. But Steve Smith has fashioned this method of working the ball around, not trying to destroy the spinners necessarily, just kind of subtly using his feet, looking for the occasional boundary, but working the ball around for singles and for twos, rotating the strike up and down the wicket, going right back onto his stumps. You know, it's great versatility of Smith, and obviously his ambition, his aspiration to keep improving and look to adapt his game wherever he's playing is the most impressive thing about him.
And he's going to be getting used to Pune as well, because he's the captain of the IPL team.
Good point. Meanwhile, India obviously licking their wounds after that first test defeat. And I think it's appropriate, actually, given that it's a rather sad Indian story, that we play a bit of music at this point. Little do people know that Sanjay Mandrekar was not only a fine batsman for India and a very good commentator who really kind of gets to the nub of an issue, but also he's recorded an album of Bengali tunes, and he's actually got a decent voice, as you can hear from this. I don't think he should give up his day job. I think, you know, it's a nice little sideline. I said to him, actually, should you maybe play a little lament in the Indian dressing room? And he said, well, maybe not. He might just keep his distance. But he has got some very good points to make, Sanjay, about how well Steve Smith played and how inadequate the Indians were.
I saw him get a 90 the last time he was here, when most Australian batsmen struggled on Indian pitches. But when he got a 90, I think may have been at Mohali. You know, you could see that he's got the feel for spin and playing on these pitches, which very few foreign batsmen, when they come here, they have that kind of a touch. So he had impressed me then as well, you know, on turning pitches. And this time round, he took it to the next level. He's a bit fortunate, but he just got a nice idea, you know, of how to handle spin, the turn and bounce, the length and everything. It's beautiful. It's more skills than anything else, you know. A lot of hand-eye coordination, bit of sense in the way he uses his feet and everything, but mostly just using that bat like a wand. And I've seen a lot of exceptional batsmen have that ability, and it you can achieve a little bit of it by practice, but it's also a gifted kind of talent. Like Mohammad Azharuddin had that feel, Sachin Tendulkar had that feel for the ball, you know. So these guys, even if they didn't get into great positions with their feet, just had that knack of hitting the ball right, you know, which is great. And what really stood out, you know, Simon, for me, is that I've seen a lot of, as I said, foreign batsmen batting turning pitches, and one of the things that always gets said is that if you can't hit boundaries and, you know, score quickly, at least look for singles. Now, picking up singles on a turning pitch is far more difficult than people think, because what you need to do is have complete control over that ball as a batsman, then put it in the gap. You know, you can take a chance with a lofted shot of four and six is sometimes easier than just putting that ball in between, say, point and picking up a single. It's a very difficult thing to do, and very few batsmen are able to do it. And that was the most impressive and the glaring difference that I saw with English batsmen and the Australian batsmen, was that every time they defended, they were looking for a run. And some of the batsmen, like Renshaw and David Warner to begin with, and then Steve Smith right through the inning, had this great ability to pick up singles or later on almost at will on those on that pitch.
Interesting. Why was the Indian batting so bad, do you think?
Well, you know, I don't know whether you saw my tweet, but ranked Turner's Indian batting has not been impressive. So you have to go back, rewind to South Africa at the time when we saw ranked Turners in India. Before that, there weren't too many ranked Turners. There was the odd one against Australia when they were here last time. But South Africa, there were a couple of venues, Nagpur and Mohali, where we had ranked Turners. Slightly better than this one, but ranked Turners. And Indian batting wasn't impressive. They barely got to 200 every time. And fortunately for them, they batted first and South Africa batted worse. If it was Australia, I think Australian batting would have done better on those pitches. But Indian batting also then gets a little exposed, you see. So what has happened is that this young sort of Indian batting that is coming through, they pride themselves on playing pace and bounce really well, and they do. They're not as wary of pace and bounce as the earlier generation of batsmen were. But what has happened is they're not great players of spin as well on these kind of testing pitches.
Well, that's Sanjay Mandrekar talking to us from India. He makes the point there that the Indian batsmen are better, he feels, against pace and spin. Is that right?
I certainly don't think they're very good against spin. Just because I think it's, you know, the amount of one-day cricket they play, the big hitting now, has made them much more intent on getting the ball over the ropes. That dexterity, that subtleness that he talks about Mohammad Azharuddin, doesn't he? That they had, the wristiness that they had in the past, possibly has been slightly relegated by being upright, being a bit more positive and being attacking and aggressive and sort of power game taking over.
If you're playing on a pitch where the ball is just spinning square and you've got DRS, isn't that almost impossible for anybody?
I think it is. It does make it much more difficult. If you're not sure when the ball's turning and when the ball is not, it's very hard to line it up. And in fact, Alistair Cook was saying after that series in Bangladesh that some of the hardest conditions he'd encountered was in those two test matches in Bangladesh, because you just didn't know, facing the Bangladeshi spinners, which balls were turning and which ones were not going to. And therefore, it's hard to... If every ball turns and you know that every ball is going to spin, you can use the angles that spin creates to make shots, to play runs. You can sweep off the stumps because you know it's going to spin past the stumps. You can maybe make a bit of room outside leg stump to allow the off-spin ball to come back towards the stumps to hit the ball against the spin on through the offside. You know, you can use the angle of spin to work balls into gaps. But if you're not sure whether it's going to turn or not, then you can't use those angles with the same confidence. You get leading edges, hit on the pad when the ball didn't turn, when you're expecting it to turn. I think, you know, when you practice against spin, if it's a spinning wicket, you know, you're in your mindset, you're sort of almost playing outside the line of the ball, which is spinning away, or inside the line of the ball, which is spinning back. And that's how you approach defending the ball. If you're not sure if it's going to turn or not, it's much harder to defend.
So is it harder to play on a pitch where the ball is turning square, or is it harder to play on a pitch where it's seaming everywhere? You know those conditions in England in May, where it's overcast.
Well, that's a very good question.
Damp. Which is harder?
That's a very good question, and I think that obviously the seam happens quicker, but the spin happens nearer to the batsman.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have less time to adjust because the ball is pitching, say, 2 yards from the batsman for a spinner, and 4 yards for the batsman from a seamer. You know, your reaction time is probably less, even though the speed is slower, 60 miles an hour to 85, say, because it's happening closer to you, you've got less time. So I'd say big turn, because it's happening nearer to the batsman, is harder to deal with. At least with swing and seam, you have got that bit of time, if your reflexes are quick, to adjust your shot.
Well, only one game's been played in the series, still three to go, so there's time for India to come back. It would be interesting to see what they come up with in terms of a pitch for the next three games of the series.
It's got to be flatter, hasn't it? They've got to give their batsmen a bit of a chance, and they didn't have any. It didn't look like they had any chance on that pitch.
Okay, let's look ahead to England against West Indies. Three one-day internationals coming up, starting later in the week, and we'll do that after this short break. Welcome back. England's preparations for the Champions Trophy continue this week when they begin a three-match one-day series against West Indies. There used to be a time, Simon, when you go to the West Indies and it would be England who would be the underdogs and the West Indies would be hugely experienced and it would be a massive test. But you feel it's very much the other way round now. England's one-day side especially is playing some good, vibrant cricket, and the West Indies... Well, so many inexperienced players. Well,
they're not even in the Champions Trophy. They didn't qualify for it. So that shows how much West Indies' reputation as a country has slumped. Obviously, they won the World T20 last year, and deservedly so, with a brilliant team. But only one of those players is appearing in this series, in this three-match one-day series, because they've all disappeared off to different parts of the world, playing T20 Premier Leagues around the place, or they've fallen out of favour with the West Indies board, which itself is going through some significant changes. You know, actually, a new man is arriving in the West Indies this week to help run it, and that will be a name familiar to a few cricket fans in England. Johnny Grave, yep. Who was the sort of player liaison officer of the PCA in England, fine man, always seen around the traps, very good at getting players along to question and answer sessions, and he's in and out of commentary boxes and hospitality boxes, and he's a great chap, and he's now taken over as West Indies CEO, so it's going to be an interesting challenge, that.
And Stuart Law is the coach as well, the Australian, former Essex player.
I mean, they're doing the right thing, I think, West Indies, to shake it all up and get some real cricket expertise in, because this is what they've had been accused of in the past, is that a lot of the board have no real cricket knowledge at all. And now they've got two people, Johnny Grave, who's absolutely steeped in the game, and obviously Stuart Law. So, you know, that's a good start. But it's such a chaotic organisation at the moment, emphasised by the constant disagreements with their leading players, who just, you know, take their bat and ball and go off and play in other parts of the world. And as a result, I just counted up the number of one-day international caps that the West Indies squad have that are playing England, and it's 166, and that's about 14 players. That's 166 in total, which is less than Owen Morgan's played on his own.
Their last one-day series was against Pakistan in the UAE. They lost that 3-0. They did play a tri-series in Zimbabwe, and they lost in that as well. They lost in the group stages. They were beaten by Zimbabwe by 6 runs. They also tied a game against Zimbabwe and lost to Sri Lanka. Although at home, they had a tri-series against Australia, South Africa last summer, our time, and they did beat South Africa a couple of times, and they beat Australia once. I mean, they have got talent, that's the thing.
They've always got talent, and looking through the list, they've certainly got a couple of guys that bowl quick. I quite like Shannon Gabriel, actually. I mean, he really does. He's an authentic, trying to run in as fast as he can and bowl as fast as he can with his massive pair of shoulders. He reminds me a little bit of the days of Sylvester Clark in the 1980s, who, you know, didn't look necessarily a particularly athletic sort of character, but blimey, he got the ball down quick. They're going to have some talented batsmen. They've already shown that with a guy making 120 against England in a warm-up game. And, you know, they have this sort of still Caribbean flair about the way they play the game, obviously emphasised or, you know, really underlined by Carlos Brathwaite's astonishing performance in that T20 World Final. But he hasn't done much since.
What sort of preparation is it for England? Champions Trophy coming up?
Any cricket's a good preparation. I suppose I think there'll be a lack of sophistication in the West Indies team. So, you know, there won't be sort of too many crafty slower balls or clever strategies in the field or batsmen probably playing too many funky shots. It'll be all a bit orthodox in the sense that the one-day game has moved on so much, you wonder whether the West Indies have caught up with that. But any cricket is going to be good. Just to play internationals in front of a big crowd, getting in scenarios where you need to score 120 off the last 10 overs or defend 100 off the last 10 overs or whatever, it's great. So good preparation, probably not as good as it might be if you're playing Australia or India, but still useful.
Now, you've been speaking to Desmond Haynes, former teammate, who I know still hasn't forgiven you for costing Middlesex the 1989 NatWest Trophy
listen
final.
Listen to this. This is me sort of trying to apologise, but he won't accept it.
Apparently, I still owe you money for the spoiler on your car. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that when I had my Mercedes, I bought it from Germany, and I just got the spoiler kit. And then we had a final to win, and you continue to bowl slow balls.
Now, you know, when you talk to Desmond, I suppose you feel this sense of disappointment, if you like, lamenting the fact that the great players of West Indies past don't seem to be incorporated in the modern administration or any of the modern setup. They seem to be outcasts. It seems, you know, a very, very poor arrangement that some of these great players are not brought into the fold and just given the opportunity to pass on their wisdom, pass on their pride in the West Indies name and the whole entity of West Indies cricket. And I think, you know, that's part of why we see so many of these very good players, the Chris Gayles, the Dwayne Bravos, Sunil Narine, etc., all disappearing off to other parts of the world because they had no pride in the West Indies name.
Also, as well, I think he makes the point that West Indies players are not really looked after after they've stopped playing. They're not really looked after by the West Indies Cricket Board as they are in other parts of the world. India, for example, they've got a pension scheme now for everybody who's played Test cricket. And Desmond makes the point that doesn't happen in the West Indies. You're not so quite as invested in West Indies cricket as a player if you think you're not necessarily going to be looked after afterwards.
But I was told that from IPL in India, the India Cricket Board look after the past greats, you know. Someone said, I think, that they get a pension for life or something like that. I don't know, but I heard something like that. And I think that that is important too, because in order for someone to be good at the sport, they must know the ones who were there before them, so that it could give them a benchmark of say, oh, I would like to be like Viv, or I like to be like Lara, or I like to be like Sadafi Sobers, or Sir Weishaupt, or something like that. But if you totally ignore the ones that were there before, and there's no provision there where is that you utilize them, like for instance, you know, we've got the cricket legends of Barbados here, and you would think that every young team on the 15, on the 13, on the 19, on the 17, should pour the Barbados cricket legends, you know, so that they can see, wow, I didn't know that we have produced so many great players from Barbados who went on to play cricket for West Indies. And I think that that could only come from the administrators, you know. If you put something in place to say when you get to play for Barbados on the 13, on the 15 or whatever, you're supposed to tour the cricket legends museum, you're supposed to know the history about the cricket legends, and you're supposed to know the history of what Barbados have produced. But, you know, you've got a situation where that, you know, cricket is a game that here in the Caribbean, that some guys can play the game before even knowing the rules.
Well, that was one half of the greatest opening partnership ever, really. Desmond Haynes and Gordon Greenidge, of course. I mean, wow, they were fantastic players. And they both, just their partnership was so symbiotic. They could work out if one was struggling, then the other one would take the bowling for a while. And they were very good at if one, say, really fancied someone, then the other one would give him the strike. And I think they scored something like 8,000 runs in partnership, didn't they, together. Just destroyers of bowling, but also with immaculate methods as well. Both of them had this sort of impregnable defence, but then, you know, if you just let them loose. I remember once Desmond actually playing in a benefit match against Northwood Cricket Club for Middlesex, and it was somebody's benefit, John Embry's benefit or someone. And normally in those situations, you reverse the batting order and the bowlers all go in to open the batting against the club side. And we got to the ground and the Northwood Cricket Club opening bowler let it be revealed that he hadn't been hit for six for about 5 years. And he was rather sort of proudly saying, oh, I'm going to get a few of you out, you know. And so we thought, oh, yeah, this is a great opportunity. And Desmond heard this and he'd sort of just arrived and he was planning to sort of put his feet up and not really take much part in the game. He said, oh, I'll have a bat. So he went out and opened the batting and hit five of the first six balls from this tall opening bowler charging in down the hill out of the ground. And he had the most incredible range of shots. I remember him scoring 200 in a match against Richard Hadley, New Zealand against Middlesex. No one else could handle Hadley at all, and Haynes just sort of knocked him around as if he was batting with a toothpick. I mean, wonderful player.
His average was only 42. I say only 42. I mean, averages seem to be higher these days, yeah, don't they? And also, I suppose you knew that if you did fail, your bowlers could get you out of trouble.
Well, of course, he didn't face his own bowlers. But actually, the fact is, only three players from the 1980s who played throughout the 1980s averaged over 50. And they were Viv Richards, Javed Miandad and Alan Border. There were a few others that averaged around that area. But if you look back at, you know, great players like Martin Crowe, Graham Gooch, Desmond Haynes, Gordon Greenidge, you know, they averaged mid-40s. It was a much tougher era to bat, even if you weren't playing the West Indies.
Yeah, you look at now, you talk about some of the top players, they're all pushing, you know, over 50, aren't they? The likes of Joe Root, for example, I think last time I looked, averages 52 in Test cricket.
And we've just had Adam Voges retiring, who's the highest Test average of anyone apart from Bradman, having played, you know, 20 Tests. And he averaged 61, didn't he? Amazing.
Right, well, you're off to the Caribbean. Should we do our...
Someone's got to do it.
Yeah, I know. It's pouring with rain outside. I'll stay back here for now. Let's do a highlight, lowlight then. You go with the highlight this week.
In a way, it's not necessarily a highlight for the player involved, but Ben Stokes last week became the richest overseas player in the IPL, getting a deal of over $2 million to play for Pune Super Giants. And then this week, he played a warm-up match for England, one over against a 20-year-old, pretty much debutant, West Indian, and his over was not for 24. So I suppose my highlight is cricket's a great leveller.
Yeah. Not as if it hasn't happened to Ben Stokes before, though, is it?
Well, his two...
He's phlegmatic about it.
His last 12 balls against the West Indies have gone for 47.
My low light, it was a fantastic test match in Pune. I followed a lot of it on the television. But it was noticeable that as the television cameras panned around the ground, there weren't that many people in the ground, which is obviously worrying for Test cricket. The one thing I would say is that ground in Pune, because we were there, is a long way out of town, which is a problem if you're trying to attract crowds. People will go there for one-off games, like the one-day international that we attended. It's also a Sunday as well. And then the other thing as well, if there's no cover for spectators, you can understand why there's this drive for day-night test match cricket. It is just so much more pleasant to watch cricket in the evening in grounds where there is no shade and there's very little in Pune. It's just a far more pleasant experience to just watch the game where the sun's not roasting you.
I totally agree. And, you know, there's a lot talked about the dew factor. Actually, I don't think there's that much dew around in a lot of these grounds. They've got ways now of negating it, nullifying it with ropes dragged round and, you know, blankets out and stuff every so often. And anyway, if there's a bit of dew, so what, really? As long as it's not saturated. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Day-night cricket, pink ball cricket's the way forward. Test matches, yeah.
Okay, Simon, enjoy the Caribbean.
Oh, I'll try.
If you can. Please leave a review on iTunes and also subscribe to us, The Analyst Inside Cricket, so you get the programme automatically each week. Click on the button where it says subscribe. So next week, Simon will be in Antigua. Or Barbados or somewhere like that.
I'll just play a little bit of the Caribbean Sea.
Thank you very much.
Rolling in, if that's all right.
You know. And I'll be in London and we'll talk to you from those different venues and different climates next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.